In 2015, a coalition of far-right groups and Christian fundamentalists held a rally in Melbourne. They called the rally Reclaim Australia. John Safran went along to take a look, to see who these people were, what they were saying. John Safran is a writer and documentary maker, and he's always been fascinated by people who live in airtight racist ideologies. And so John was a little surprised to see who was on the podium at the rally that day. These spokespeople for traditional Aussie values. The whole thing was so surprisingly multiracial. So John decided to go around the country, taking the temperature of modern Australian extremism. John spent time with white nationalists, with Islamic jihadists, Jewish militants, and anarchist protesters. John Safran's adventures among this collection of people who can't change their minds and won't change the subject is laid out in his new book that's called Depends What You Mean by Extremist, Going Rogue with Australian Deplorables. Welcome back, John.
Hey, how are you?
Fine, sir. You like to keep on white nationalists. I'm going to quote you from early on in your book. You say, I've been into racists since high school. What's going on there? What's the source of fascination there, John?
Well, I guess when you grow up Jewish, there's always these things kind of floating about, especially in my age bracket, where you had like grandparents who'd escaped the war. And so no one would actually like sit you down. You wouldn't have like lessons or like, oh, watch this documentary, or at least in my, it wasn't like that at all, but it was just, you know, as sure as you soak up the smells of your, the food of your particular ethnicity, oh, that's the smell of chicken soup and that sticks with you to life. You know, I obviously just picked up enough of these sort of like half conversations when I was really young from, you know, different old Jewish people that like, I reckon that like that's a big part of it. And then,
so you mean like there's this kind of, you grow up with this idea that one day there could be just like, you know, a knock at the door and someone might take your parents
away. Oh, no, in my case, it's more like, you're not classic white.
Right.
You know, like there's something different from, you know, from you and, you know, some person who does carols by candlelight and then goes on a holiday to Rye or Rosebud or, you know, not in a bad way or a dramatic way. I guess that was sort of like, so at a very young age, there's that. And then at a very young age, like a lot of people, I went to Sunday school. And then so
you went to Sunday school?
Yeah.
What, Jewish Sunday school?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, right, okay, right.
And so you start hearing these stories from the Bible about God, you know, asking someone to kill their child on the altar, and like, so that kind of gets thrown into it and you go, wow, is this Judaism or whatever? Yeah, so I don't know. I guess I just took all these things when I was really young, I soaked them up and took them way too seriously or something.
I'm a doubter by temperament. I think you probably are too. I'm guessing that, aren't you? So is there something kind of like, how can you be like that? Is it like this to absolutely believe and to not be bothered by contradictions or the kind of intrusion of the outside world? Is that part of it, or am I putting words in your mouth here?
Oh, no, I definitely see the attraction because it's like, maybe for some people it's like, oh, if I kind of take this drug or something, or if I get drunk, I'm going to go into this different mind state or whatever. And so with these extreme ideologies, especially if they're like, to have religious flavorings to them, it's kind of like that. Like you can, you know, you sit down and read this religious text or this extreme thing, and it kind of get lost in it, and you kind of you get on a bit of a high,
natural high, from hanging out with extremists. Yeah. So let's go to this rally at the start of this book that starts out in mid 2015. It was being held in front of the Victorian Parliament. Once you heard about this through your various networks that you follow very closely through social media, what was the spectacle like? What did you see when you showed up at this rally, John?
Well, I guess I was really interested because there was a big right-wing presence on the streets of Melbourne, and Melbourne's seen as, you know, the ultimate cosmopolitan, multicultural success story.
Like, yeah, such nice cafes just across the road from there, aren't they?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I guess as a Melbournean, I was like used to seeing lefties on the street, you know, protesting against climate change or for refugees. And it was just strange to me that there was this thing that seemed vital and of the moment, but it was like extreme right wing as opposed to left wing, and you just don't usually see that on the streets of Melbourne. And I guess also because I'd grown up being interested in these kind of far right groups and other things, that usually they were just these oddballs from the past. So, like, my last book, for example, I have to go into the forest of Mississippi to kind of find these Klansmen, because that's how antiquated the whole thing was. And then, but suddenly, within, you know, a few years, where you know, like with Trump and everything like that, this has now become on the streets and become sort of mainstream. This sort of like this weird, esoteric, extreme right-wingness that was just so odd. And
so it was like off. Seeing Rosicrucians show up or something like
that. Absolutely. It was quite confusing. And then there's such an energy at these rallies that as an artist, you really pick up on, like, where it's so different from, like, sitting at home and reading about things on your computer.
And how many people are we talking about at this rally? Like, what, 50, 100?
For this first rally, maybe on the far right side, there were a couple of hundred, and then there's, like, 1,000 on the left-wing side. And the left were trying to really pitch this as, this is like white supremacists versus non-white people. And so even though they're saying that they're anti-Islam, what they really are, this is just white supremacy and Muslims are brown, and so it's really just brown people versus white people. But then, as you said before, yeah, it was weird, 'cause I turn up there and on the so-called white supremacist side, there's all multicultural Australia.
Yeah, the Reclaim Australia rally you wrote began with a white woman on the back of a truck playing her respects to the Wiradjuri people.
Yes.
Of the land. Now, I didn't see that coming. Did you see that coming? No.
It's because when you have an enemy, you often try to say, well, who isn't my enemy that I can now sort of bring into my fold? So, for instance, in her case, that woman, she's an evangelical Christian, and so she has a problem with Islam and with Muslims, but sincerely doesn't have a problem with Aboriginal Australians. And so either consciously or subconsciously, she knows it's, you know, it's going to help her in her prosecution of her case against Islam to say, listen, I'm not a racist. I have no problem with Aboriginal Australians. And in fact, that's one of the real interesting things that came up again and again on my journey is these people who are anti-Islam and quite sincerely try to connect their story to that of Aboriginal Australians, like saying, oh, listen, they were like driven off when people came in and didn't respect their culture, so we've got to...
Really?
Yeah. And also they see themselves as we're Indigenous Australians in a way, we're white Indigenous, and they're the, you know...
So they're looking for some kind of Aboriginal cred.
Absolutely.
So then a man named Pastor Danny Nalia took over on the microphone in this so-called racist rally that was going on. But he's from Sri Lanka.
Yeah, he's a Sri Lankan immigrant. And so one thing is, part of unlocking this riddle is that religion plays a bigger part in what drives people in Australia than is often discussed. So, for instance, everyone's just been talking about these anti-Islam groups and as if they're all white bogans, quote unquote, and they're just like the people who were anti-Asian 20 years ago, and it's just that again or whatever. But there's a real, amongst the power players, like Christianity plays a big role. And in this way that I think people get confused about, because I think lots of Aussies just don't get that there are still people who are religious and they believe in scripture. And
completely and totally.
Yeah. And probably like the sharpest example of this is they want to bring about the messianic age. And I kind of understood this, but I didn't get that everyone didn't get this, because I went to a very religious Jewish school where they believed in, listen, we've got to bring about the Messiah. And I saw how they're like normal people and nice people and stuff, but they sincerely believe this. It's not like some cultural thing. It's not like a bagel or sort of like a dress. It's like they have magical thinking that is in my day-to-day life, from doing rituals to how I eat to why I have children and how I bring up my children, it's we're going to bring about the Messiah. So therefore, when I'm outside of that, and I either have, a Muslim person who wants to fight for ISIS saying, you know, in the scripture it says we've got to go to Syria or where the land where it's now is Syria because that's where the messianic age is going to play out. Or when I've got these evangelical Christians like Pastor Daniel Nalia who are saying, you know, Islam's a threat and we've got to do this thing to help bring about the Christian Messiah, it totally makes sense to me.
Like to take them at their word. It's not code for another thing. It actually is
is what it is. And it took me ages to realise, because I'm slow, that everyone didn't grow up going to Yeshiva College with Hasidic Jews. So that kind of concept's kind of confusing. So this whole thing that, oh, if anyone says anything about religion, they don't really mean it. It's actually a code. It's actually because Pastor Daniel's brown and he wants to suck up to white Australians, so therefore he's pretending he's got a problem with Islam. You know, it's this.
But he does have a problem with Islam.
Yeah, yes. And it's a scriptural problem. It's not even a problem necessarily that he's got a problem, say, with terrorism. It's like if people follow the Quran, they're going to end up in hell.
So the stakes are really high.
Yeah, the stakes are really high.
Yeah. Well, after sort of seeing that bunch at the rally there, yes, and the Reclaim, you went looking for the proper white nationalists who were there. The guys who look like bikies, in other words, essentially at this rally, who go under the name, in this case, of the United Patriots Front. They were there. Now, these are the proper white nationalists. They recognised you, John, as a recognisably prominent Jewish Australian filmmaker?
Well, it's like a combo of... When you're actually there in the real world, it really is a big call for someone to, like, throw a fist at you. And so I think people are a bit disoriented that I don't care about turning up there, even though I'm not meant to be there. And so I didn't end up getting punched. I ended up getting a bit of threats of violence. But, again, I kind of didn't know how to take it, like...
And were they directed you at for being someone from the media or for being Jewish or both? Was it was
kind
they
of,
pointed
yeah, kind
Jewish
of both. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Everyone was, I mean, one of the cool things about going on this journey is all sides had real stakes with the Jews, you know. So you have these far-right people who, you know, in the case of some of the leadership in the United Patriots Front, they literally... have, like, gone on, like, saying, you know, there should be a picture of Hitler in every classroom. So, obviously, they've got a problem with Jews. Then you've got some of the Muslim people I hung out with who are, like, really extreme, and both because the Quran mentions the Jews, and then also there's so much tension about Israel, which is a Jewish state, and so they've got real issues with the Jews. And then you've got the extreme left who sort of end up, like, everything's really about Israel again. And so everyone's just got their issues with the Jews, which is kind of, like, maybe bad for the world, but kind of cool if you're a writer. It couldn't be better, no. Sorry, Jews. It was good for me, though.
If these white supremacists hate multiculturalism so much and sort of want to defend traditional Aussie values, and some of their leaders are into, like, posting images of Hitler and saying how much they like Hitler and admire Hitler, why are they sharing a platform with such a multiracial crew as the Catch the Fire Ministries?
Well, everyone's trying to leverage everyone else for their own tribalism. So when I turned up for the first time and you see Pastor Daniel, the Sri Lankan immigrant, with Blair Cottrell, the white guy from the United Patriots Front, on the back of the ute, like, your first assumption could be, oh, this poor, innocent, you know, brown guy being exploited by the United Patriots Front because they want to have cover and not look like they're racist, so they can say, oh, listen, how are we racist? We're kind of...
We're pro-white rather than anti-black. Is that what their argument would be, or
well,
no?
Well, there's combos. There's ones who are just against Islam, and then there are ones who are actually white nationalists, and they know they can't get away with saying that. So they frame it as saying, oh, we have a problem with Islam. And it's sort of how to draw people in, and then at a later stage, they'll try to upsell them to saying, oh, listen, now that I've caught your attention by getting you against the Muslims, let me tell you about the Jews and the blacks. I don't even know how to, like, there's so much madness. There is talk that Blair Cottrell, who's the head of the United Patriots Front, is, people started noticing, like, lefties who were there at the rally as protesters and also me as a journalist there, started noticing that he doesn't really bag Islam that much. Like, he's on the microphone and he's talking about this greater force that is controlling the world. And it's like, hang on, aren't you meant to be the leader of an anti-Islam group? But you don't really say that much about Islam. And then the kind of people started clinging on to, oh, he's not actually that he's like a, you know, he's...
So he's got a kind of an alliance of convenience within his own group.
Yeah, he's got an alliance of convenience, and he's seen anti-Islam come along and seen how it can be just acceptable in the mainstream in a way that, like, being anti-black or anti-Jewish, you just, like, people would freak out. And so he's sort of, like, leveraging onto that to sort of... to his advantage.
So what happened when you posted some of your observations about Pastor Danny, the Sri Lankan migrant and other migrants sharing a stage with these white nationalists and, in some cases, white supremacists, about these quote-unquote people of colour sharing a stage with white nationalists?
Well, some are different things. Some sort of people who are, like, really into identity politics got really annoyed with me.
With you?
Yeah, because I wanted to keep it simple. It's like... anti-Islam is really just classic racism. It's just like 20 years ago with Pauline Hanson and Asians, but now it's been updated. And then me sort of going in there and going, oh, hang on, why is this brown person? And it's not just him. He's got his own multicultural church of evangelical Christians who are mainly immigrants from Asia and India and Africa, and they kind of turn up to these anti-Islam rallies and are in sort of partnership in this weird way with the white nationalists. It's, so the whole thing's so confusing. So, and so people who are, like, really into identity politics were, like, some of them were, like, annoyed at me. Like, why are you trying to confuse this issue? And like as if I'm making trouble or I'm making something out of nothing or something like that.
So the Catch the Fire Ministries, you went out to Mildura for the conference they were holding. They were launching their own political party for the last federal election in 2016. They're very much in favour. I've looked at their website. Of traditional Aussie values.
Well,
they say that a lot. Traditional Aussie values. Yeah. But I don't know. What does this look like to you, John?
Well, one thing I noticed is that, or one thing that's interesting about Pastor Daniel Nalea and also a lot of his congregants is he didn't come to Australia till after 1990. So he missed Pauline Hanson, and he missed everything beforehand. So he doesn't have all this baggage and this history that lots of, like, white Australians have. And so, therefore, he's kind of, like, just way more comfortable. He's just had a different life, basically, than white Australians who've been here for lots of generations. So, for instance, if you're a white Australian, family been here for lots of generations, you look at these things like anti-Islam and go, oh, my God, this is like the Pauline Hanson thing, and this is making me uncomfortable. Or this is like the 1940s and 50s where people were against the Greeks and Italians, and this is another incarnation. It's making me very uncomfortable. But that's just not... Pastor Daniel wasn't here. His family wasn't here for all of that. He arrived after the first incarnation of Pauline Hanson, so he just doesn't have this perspective like that and his baggage, and so it's really twisted. Because I'm basically saying, if you're saying you have to look at things through other people's eyes and not look at things through the eyes of just white Australians, you're going to get into these weird situations where you have to say, well, Pastor Daniel is like that because his experience is very different to a white Australian.
Yeah, but for all this upholding of traditional Aussie values, Pastor Danny has described bottle shops as Satan's strongholds. Oh, yes. Now that's going to get a bit of backlash, isn't it, amongst the traditional Aussie values crowd? I mean, things are more than Australian than a bottle shop, I reckon, John.
Well, that's sort of, I guess what's funny or interesting is if you're a Christian immigrant who's recently come to Australia, you can just oversimplify things and somehow think white Australia is a Christian nation, and it kind of isn't. And it's certainly not in this sort of, like, it's not like pilgrims came.
No, it's not like the United States.
Yeah, the United States. Except, so you have people like Pastor Daniel who believe that Australia, the Australian story is about Christianity. And so he's coming along and he's joining this Christian nation. But it clearly isn't, because he had a fight, like, with Barnaby Joyce, who, you know, he's a classic Aussie. You know, he's got the Akubra. He's sort of riding a tractor. And he kind of laughs at Pastor Daniel and says, like, what the hell are you going on about, you know, that the bottle shops are
Satan's strongholds.
Satan's strongholds. Yeah, so there's this whole tension where things just don't fit because Australia just isn't, you can't even, like, overgeneralise and say that sort of, like, the history of white Australia is this classic thing about evangelical Christianity or something, because it just isn't.
Going along, you went to this special Catch the Fire Jewish event.
Yes.
Where Jews who were Messianic Christians were going along. Yes. These are people who were born Jewish, but they believe in they believe in Jesus as the Messiah, as the Jewish Messiah.
Yeah.
And Havana Gila is being sung. And then, amazingly,
yes,
Blair Cottrell, the white nationalist, pro-Hitler guy,
yeah,
from the United Patriots Front, walked in. What does he make of a room full of fundamentalist Christians singing Hava Nagila?
Yeah, and having Israeli flags hung up everywhere. It's just, I don't know what he made. I didn't know. I was just so excited. There was this total weirdness going on where, and it's part of everyone leveraging everyone else. So for some on the far right, they want to say, oh, listen, we're not racist. Look how much we like Jews. And so they sort of like leverage that. And then that becomes its own tangle, because then you've got those on the far right who have a problem with Israel, like Blair, and then those on the far right who don't have a problem. And then basically your head collapses.
You went out to interview a man named Ralph.
Yes.
In his flat in Sydney. Tell me a bit about his background.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was one of the speakers at these United Patriots Front events, and he's got like Aussie pride written on his top. And he, unprompted, because I was just there minding my own business, little old John Safran with my little recorder, and he had a go at me in front of like all the hundreds of patriots saying, yeah, that John Safran, he's causing trouble. He's always printing in the paper that we're Nazis, and everyone turns and boos me or whatever. And as usual, like, I was like, it's quite scary, but, you know, probably good for the book. And then, anyway, so I decided to just to turn up unannounced one night at his house to kind of try to find out.
Did that freak him out a bit?
Yes. Like, and I buzzed on his buzzer, and he said, oh, who's this? I said, it's John Safran. He goes, how did you find out where I lived? He was, like, really bowled over, and I just told him, oh, I typed your name into White Pages. All these people are so easy to contact. It's like, it's really, like, you just think, like, yeah, if you get out of your house, it's really easy to find these people. Anyway, so I went up to his flat, and he's meant to be, you know, one of these epitomes of, like, white nationalism or whatever. But I noticed his surname was Seminara. So I said to him, I go, oh, so, you know, you're from an Italian family? And he goes, oh, yeah, my dad's Italian. Mum's Aboriginal. And so I'm like, oh, what? Yeah. And then I fall down this entire rabbit hole that this guy who's presented, particularly by the left, as being this sort of like white nationalist leader.
It's Italian Aboriginal.
Yeah, Italian Aboriginal. And then
values tattooed across his chest, right.
And then whilst I'm kind of talking to him at his house and getting a bit drunk or whatever, I see this baby crawls into the room. And I can't help but notice it's an Asian baby. And I say to him, to the white nationalist, the Italian Aboriginal white nationalist, I go, oh, you know, what's up with the Asian baby? And he's like, oh, yeah, my wife's Vietnamese. So then I put to him, I say, listen, don't you understand that people look at, like, groups you're involved with and they say, 20 years ago, these are the kind of people who would have been against Vietnamese people, like your wife, and 40 years ago, they would have been against Italian people, like your father, and he just, like, he refused to budge.
He didn't go there. He wasn't interested in that.
He wasn't interested in that. He was still determined to be
Did that just bore him, or when you were trying to point out the contradictions, did that bore him, or?
He talked about how there's a distinction between religion and ethnicity, so he's just very logically against Islam as a religion, which is very different to being Asian or Aboriginal or Italian or even Arab as an ethnicity. And one weird thing is, like, you can all have a laugh at Ralph for saying that, but there's the Australian law kind of is all confused itself about all these issues. So you have this Australian federal anti-discrimination law in which a Jewish person took some Holocaust denier to court and tried to prosecute him under the law, and religions aren't covered. So this person had to define Judaism as a people as opposed to a religion, and the courts accepted that. But so now the law's in this twisted state where if you're a Jew or a Sikh, apparently, you're covered under the federal anti-discrimination.
Racial discrimination.
Yeah, racial discrimination. But if you're a Muslim, you're not, because the law considers Islam a religion because I guess their logic is it's it's so expansive and there's so many ethnicities under the whatever. But that just shows how confusing the law is anyway.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and on your mobile.
Now, you were speaking there before about Ralph, one of the extremists, a white supremacist from an Italian Aboriginal background.
With
a Vietnamese wife and a child. Now, he warned you that someone who was so publicly and obviously Jewish as yourself, whatever you should do, you should never go to Lakemba.
Yep.
It's just too dangerous.
Yep.
Yeah. So what happened then?
Yeah, because he said, he goes, do not go to Heldon Street. Because he was always in biffo with police and Muslims. And I kind of suspected it was more to do with him wearing a T-shirt that said, like, ban Islam.
Right,
and
yeah.
Walking down the
street.
Anyway, but
he
was claiming to me, he was saying, John, because you're Jewish, if you go to Lakemba and wearing a Jewish skull cap, you'll get just beaten up
right.
or whatever. So I kind of forgot about it when I left his house. And then it's like months later and I happen to be in around the area for another reason. I go, oh, might as well do it or whatever. So I kind of got a bit of costuming together.
Yeah, what kind of costuming? How far did you go with that?
Well, I decided like I'd wear the skull cap. I had one of those. And then I thought, listen, I don't want anyone to think that sort of like there's any ambiguity. So I wore these little tassels like that Tevye has on Fiddler on the Roof, that religious Jews. So I'm wearing those.
Right, a tab sort of shirt, you mean? Like that kind
yeah,
of
yeah, yeah, like these tassels or whatever. Right. Then also I was holding a copy of the Australian Jewish News, just to make sure. And he said Heldon Street for some reason. It was like, if you walk down Heldon Street, you will get beaten up, right? So I start like walking at my car and past these kids who I assume were Muslim or whatever, waiting for them to say something, you know, and they don't care. And then I start walking out of Heldon Street. No one cares. It's not even like, first of all, lots of the people there were in their own garb, you know, their own like non-Anglo garb, you know, people with African backgrounds and people with Arab backgrounds. So they were like, but I'm just like walking up and down, like just waiting for, not only, I'd really given up, I was going to get beaten up. But, like, for anyone, for there to be, like, anything. But it's, like, people, like, wearing niqabs and stuff. Like, why do they care that I'm walking up and down with a Jewish skull cap? And, well, yeah, so basically no matter how long I spent there, I spent, like, about an hour there walking up and down trying to get beaten up.
No shouts from random cars. Nothing like
no,
that.
No, nothing. Nothing at all.
Right.
Nothing at all. Just saying, I walked into shops to sort of chupa chups and stuff like that. Nothing.
So not even the kind of abuse you were getting from white supremacists.
No.
Ralph.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. It seems to me the thing that a lot of these groups have in common is that they really think multicultural Australia is impossible and it doesn't exist. And so hence he would actually believe, I'm sure he believed him. He was being sincere when he said you get beaten up. But of course, people by and large aren't like that. They're not willing to beat up people just for walking down a street, even if they are being garbed such as you were at the time.
I was happy to get beaten up for the book. I thought it would have been good, but I just wasn't beaten up.
You just weren't, so.
But this constant, I was really, this constant sort of like threat of violence hovering around everywhere was weird to me. Even like this morning, a person from the Patriots who got a copy of my book, like sent me a message and where it was like, oh, I can't believe you said all this or that. He goes, you know, at that rally, I stopped all these people were going to kind of give you a one over, like basically saying they were all going to beat me up and he stopped it. But now he's sort of regretting stopping them beating me up now that he's read the book or whatever. Like, it's really confusing, this sort of all this talk of violence and like what you're meant to make of it. Like, am I meant to be scared or
meant to be intimidated?
Yeah,
that's the thing, aren't you?
Yeah, but like, should I take it seriously or not? Or is this like online where everyone just says anything and really 999 times out of 1,000 you just shouldn't care? And I don't know.
So you also spent plenty of time with a man named Musa Serantonio, who's known but often called in the media the white jihadist. What's his story, John?
He's in a jail cell at the moment awaiting court case.
Yes.
That hasn't even been scheduled, the court case, because he was part of a group of young men who, became, well, kind of famous for a week, I guess, in the media, maybe about 4 months ago, 5 months ago, I don't know, six months ago. And they were called the Tinny Jihadis. And I don't know if people remember that. And I think they were all from Melbourne, and they bought a secondhand tinny, a boat from a suburb in Melbourne, or in Victoria, I mean, and then they drove it all the way to far north Queensland, and then they were jumped by the police when they got there, and the police say they were... Do you have the legal...
I do, yeah. Well, they were charged with making preparations for incursions into foreign countries for the purpose of engaging in hostile activities. That's what they were charged with. So you're meeting up with him, obviously, before all this happens.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So I was, like, hanging out with him so often, like, before this happened. And I got a real insight and into at least elements of a person who kind of ends up in that place.
So how did he made contact with you, didn't he? So initially. Why were you interesting to him?
The initial contact happened. I was actually poking around for another Islamic dude who just an editor at a paper I sometimes write for would say, oh, there's this Aboriginal Muslim dude. You should catch up with him and, you know, do his story. And while sort of like poking around trying to chase down that dude, this other dude, Musa, got back to me and said, oh, you know, I'm a big fan of your shows.
Really?
Yes.
Right.
It was very strange because he'd talk about things I'd done on my show, Race Relations, and...
So he's a convert, right? Yes. He was born into a Catholic family in Melbourne,
yep.
Italian-Australian Catholic family. How influential was he before his arrest amongst radical Islamist would-be jihadis?
Well, he'd got on a TV show in Egypt, of all places, because he was considered such a good public speaker. And I think people thought he was good because he managed to kind of marry the West in some ways with Islam. And he was like interested in Western things and often did his sort of Muslim spin on them. So on his TV show, he'd talk about the story of Dracula and, you know, the Islamic roots of that story and, you know, and...
So he became a star in Egypt.
Yes.
What kind of a relationship has he had with ASIO over the years? I mean, ASIO were aware of his activities instead of banging on his door.
Yes, yes. And he actually told me that, yeah, it's not rare for ASIO to be poking around and trying to get people who are Muslim Australians who have some influence to sort of like try to get them on board and, hey, why don't you just, you know, tell us if you see anything.
Oh, they were trying to get him to inform, were they?
Inform's a bit of a woolly term.
So keep them apprised of conversations and events.
Yeah, yes. So, but I guess what was really interesting about him was, because I guess you have a stereotype about the type of person who is going to end up with the things that the police alleged and, you know, what are his influences or whatever. And one of his big things, like, he just grew up and he was, like, a huge Monty Python fan. And
like, to the point where he would, like...
Quote lines. Yeah, right. Yeah, like him and his brother's not Muslim. And they'd be there kind of quoting lines from, like, Life of Brian and all this stuff. And I sort of, like, often tried to join the dots with him. I like, how can you be such a fan of Life of Brian, which is this kind of critique of organized religion? Like, how can you be such a fan of that and sort of like see the humor in that and the madness in that? He was also a big fan. He grew up with Mad Magazine, like I
did. Right, so he likes satire.
Yeah, yes. Right. And especially with Mad Magazine, and also with Monty Python, but with Mad Magazine, I just remembered I'd grown up with Mad Magazine, and like when I was really young, like grade 5, grade 6, and it had this real impact on how I saw the world. And so it was really interesting to me that I'd met this dude who had ended up in a totally different place, and he'd also, you know, grade 5, grade 6, had read Mad Magazine. but somehow, like, that didn't stop him from being a supporter of these kind of more radical things.
So what does a white jihadi like Musa think of international socialists, Trotskyite groups who want to defend their right to be here and to be part of Australia and defend Muslims?
Oh, yeah, well, that's kind of really interesting because obviously if you're a devout Muslim, that to you, Islam is a religion. And I mean, maybe I'm just stating the obvious, but then you have like the lefties who are trying to stand up for, you know, Muslims, and so they don't experience discrimination, and they don't perceive, you know, they're not necessarily perceiving Muslims as having individual religious beliefs that might be contrary to left-wing beliefs and to socialist beliefs. So, yeah, so he was like quite cynical of like, he was like, oh, you know, we don't need these lefties standing up for us. They think socialism is an affront and a danger to Islam. And yeah, so there is like this awkward clash. And also for someone, I'm not saying Musa particularly, but for people, you know, in that scene, they often see people who are like Muslims who have left the faith, have become apostates. They see them as like, that really rattles them,
right,
and makes them really, you know, I could see it in their faces. Like, and in this weird way, they found things like Pauline Hanson or the United Patriots Front less offensive, like,
than liberalism, you mean, or the left?
You know, Muslims who become liberal Muslims or Muslims who leave the faith.
Do you know, that reminds me, like, I read an article once by this man in the United States called Dinesh D'Souza, who's a neoconservative, who wrote this about 10 years ago, where the thing he really hated was the left. He really hated small-L liberals.
Yeah.
And he said, he wrote, if we're forced to choose between something like Al-Qaeda and secular, atheistic, godless liberalism, he wrote, I'm quoting here, that the man with the long beard might be more attractive to him.
Seems
to be this thing. Maybe the thing that, again, they really don't like liberalism, I suppose. That's the thing. They see that as deceptive or wishy-washy or something.
Well, yeah, there's definitely like one of the weird alliances that I kind of touch on in the book is that if you're a conservative Christian, like Fred Nile, for instance, you might look at conservative Islam, as long as it, you know, you're not blowing up, and go, they're my partners. In fact, they do. In fact, and I talk to Rabbi Gutnick, this Melbourne rabbi who I talked to, and he's just quite comfortable. He was like, you know, like, no, it would be great if Australia became more religious, and part of that would be more Islam, part of that would be more Christianity and more kind of devout Judaism or whatever. So it's not like necessarily just because you're a conservative Christian you're going to be looking at, like some of them do, like Pastor Daniel, but there's other conservative Christians like Fred Nile who look at conservative Islam and say, well, these can be my partners. They also they have a problem with liberalism.
Same-sex marriage.
They have a problem with same-sex marriage. And so we can be partners. Yeah, it's really, it's so massively confusing. And where you can really go wrong as a trying to process it is just assuming, just living in the present tense and so assuming that all Christians are against Muslims and all Jews are against Muslims.
There's no neat axis here, is there?
There's so many like long histories to all these things. So yeah, and histories that go way obviously before 9/11 and before Pauline Hanson and stuff. And
Go back to the Crusades back to the Old Testament and several thousand years BC. Now, the Q Society, an interesting organisation, they popped into the media. Their profile really leapt in the media when they held a dinner not so long ago, which was attended by people like former cartoonist Larry Pickering and Ross Cameron, who does the Outsider show on Sky News, where they just neither could stop talking about homosexuals and how much they disdained them or didn't like them.
Yeah.
And the Q Society seemed to be embarrassed by that. They describe themselves on their website, John, as the Q Society of Australia is a not-for-profit civil rights organisation. Run by a dedicated group of volunteers, our supporters come from different ethnicities and creeds, all bound by a common goal to inform Australians about Islam. You showed up at one of their meetings. What do they like to talk about at their meetings?
Oh, yeah, well, I kind of got into them in the early days, you know. I was like a Q Society hipster.
Before they became fashionable.
Yeah, I was like a Q Society hipster. And I was like desperate to find out about them because all they were was a P.O. box. And so unlike these other anti-Islam groups where I figured out a way in, they kept on just putting up these barriers and I just did not know how to get through to them. But what I was curious about is that in my Melbourne Jewish community, I'd heard a few rumours that maybe this is like a Jewish organisation and maybe what it really is, it's about Israel and and they're anti-Islam through that. And so therefore they're trying to put on a sort of a mainstream face, like, oh, we're just regular Australians, but actually they're, you know, Zionists who are against Palestinians and therefore against Islam through that thing.
And so then you, but then you head towards that old trope of the secretive Jewish organization.
Yeah, exactly. So then I sort of like kept chasing and trying to find out it was true, because the people who were telling me it was a secret Jewish organization, some of them were the, you know, the neo-Nazis. So am I meant to take their word for it? And like, so I finally got access, and even though there were some Jewish members, it wasn't a Jewish organization. Again, I was kind of furious because I would have liked to have uncovered a secret Jewish conspiracy.
But it wasn't quite like that. You showed up at one of their meetings dressed as a bushy, kind of, with reflecto sunglasses.
Yeah, I had to sneak in because I'd already been rejected. They'd put me on their banned list. And so I had to go in dress-ups to try to get into one of their meetings, which I did. I dressed up as a classic Aussie, and I grew a beard for 2 months. And I wore these mirror sunglasses, and I got through. It was great. And also Ralph was there, who we spoke about before, and he didn't recognize me. So I knew I'd got away with it. I also went for got a fake tan.
Right.
I tried to look like a regular Australian. But the Q Society, like so many of these other groups, there seemed to be this like second agenda that was their real thing, and them looking at anti-Islam as a way to kind of get regular Australians to sort of, and to present themselves as regular Australians. So in the case of the United Patriots Front, they're actually white nationalists, but you don't get away with that. So present yourself as a group that's, you know, against Islam and...
Right, so that's perceived to be a kind of catnip at the moment.
Yes,
is it political
yes.
catnip? You put that in front.
Yeah, and then you've got these evangelical Christians who might be mainly against Islam because they think it's a spiritual danger. And they're not going to, like, you're not going to get away with saying that. Everyone's going to think you're Fruit Loops. So then, again, you're sort of like...
I'm worried about Islam, halal certification.
Yeah, yes.
But really, it's about introducing people. So that's supposed to get people through the door.
Yes, yes. And to across as normal, you know. And also, obviously, with the Q Society, you know, if there were Zionist Jews involved in that, and this is their way of sort of coming across as regular Australians.
You finally got to meet Blair Cottrell, the UPF leader, the one who once posted something about how a picture of Hitler should be put in every Australian classroom.
Yes.
Okay. So, fond of Hitler, it's fair to say, I think, under that. Yeah. It's not going to be outrageous to say that. This was at a barbecue in Bendigo. Now, he's quite physically powerful, this guy. He's quite buff, isn't he? He's a bit of a gym bunny. Yes. Works out quite a bit. He's a racist who thinks Hitler never quite got a fair shake. Were you intimidated by him, meeting him physically? You know?
Well, I'd sort of been desensitised a bit because I'd seen him from a distance at these rallies. Generally, I found it easy to kind of just get desensitised to him. So I didn't feel like that threatened by him, but he's quite a young guy in his early 20s, and one thing I found interesting about all these young people involved in, first of all, that there are young people involved in these far-right groups, because when I was formally interested in them, they're all like cranky old men, you know, from a bygone era, so it was interesting that there's people in their late teens and 20s who are into this. And the other thing is that they spend a lot of time on the internet, and they have this kind of like ideological mishmash of different things. So they'll be reading about libertarianism in America, like Ron Paul or something, and then they take a bit of that and try to apply it to Australia, even though our histories are so different that kind of doesn't even make sense that much. And then they'll grab a little bit of European anti-Semitism and bundle that in together, and then a bit of Australian stuff that's unique to Australia. And it just becomes this kind of cultural mashup of impossible to unpick ideologies. It's sort of like so different to, you know, ideologies that were around like 10 years ago.
You know what, so many people like him remind me of? They remind me of Hitler in Vienna. You know, people who would be otherwise inconsequential. Their politics wouldn't, you know, politically they would, without their ideology, they wouldn't really make much of an impact on anything really. And this is a kind of, the ideology is what they latch onto. something to elevate them and to make them larger than they really are. I remember, you know, when I was in my early teens and early 20s, I used to know some skinheads who'd sort of appropriated a bit of racist ideology, but really half-heartedly. They kind of enjoyed the shock value of it. They really enjoyed how otherwise they'd just be guys on the dole. But this made them kind of a bit scary and made them puff them up and made them bigger than what they were. I mean, what do you think of that?
Yeah, no. Definitely there was an element where, like, one dimension where I was thinking after hanging out with some of these young men who were extreme, was that if you went to university and became a lawyer, or you started a business, and you're seen, you got this kind of masculine pride, and you got people like respecting you for being a man, and if you sort of screwed up that era of your life and suddenly you're in your mid-20s and you're not in an occupation where people are just by default in some level respecting you, like, this is a shortcut to being a king.
Yeah.
And especially with social media, it's a bit like a version of on Instagram, like, so many people are somehow semi-implying their models when really it's like, it's totally self-created, and you can do that these days. And these young far-right people are do a version of that where they can. It's easy to set up a sort of an online thing where it looks bigger than it really is, and you get to become a king within this movement. And there's definitely an element of like young men having a shortcut to being able to present themselves as a king and as a man.
In the end, I kind of get a sense of your growing rage and frustration against many of these people. And I really like that, actually. Yes. I certainly saw that in a documentary you made about the election too. In the end, you just, you kind of begin being really curious, and then you sort of going, like that. Where did you end up in all this, John? I have to ask you this because it's not in your book. Where have you landed on this? Or where are you coming from politically? What ideals do you want to uphold in the face of this extremism?
I thought that small L liberalism gets quite a bad rap by people who are even slightly sort of a bit too left, not a bit too, but a left wing or right wing. But I thought it's kind of maybe that's sort of it's. It's good to have a society where there's a balance and a mix of things, and definitely having small L liberal people in the mix of things is a healthy thing.
Right, yeah. So even though you can't stand them by and large,
I did find it interesting that things that I kind of made jokes about, like, you know, oh, let's take the mickey out of, you know, people for being, you know, small L liberal or something like that. Like, these people who are a bit more radical take very seriously and almost dangerously seriously. So, for instance, something that I might make a joke about, like, oh, my God, aren't atheists sort of, like, really cocky and they think they know everything and blah, blah, and I'll do jokes about it. And you're like, why not? Kind of, mate. But by the time it gets to these sort of more radical people, it's like they hold that opinion, but in the most dangerous, where it's like, you know, in the case of, you know, some radical Muslims, it will be like, no, atheists are the most dangerous, like, they hate atheists. They think atheism's more dangerous than religion, and atheism's more dangerous than, it's the worst thing ever. And it's like, Jesus Christ. Like, I was just kind of joking about it and sort of like, you know, it's good to kind of like have a go at the atheist in some kind of context, you know, but I'm not sure they're more dangerous than religion.
Great to speak with you, John, once again. Hope you had a nice long hot shower after your adventures amongst many, many of these people. Yeah. They were a lot of fun to be with and slightly scary to be with at the same time. Great to speak with you, John, and thank you so much.
No, thank you very much.
John Safran is the author of Depends What You Mean by Extremist, Going Rogue with Australian Deplorables. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
If- It's science.
For me as a scientist.
It's culture.
Imagine.
And everything in between.
Do you know what this means?
Natasha Mitchell here. Join me for season one of Science Friction. From radioactive Boy Scouts to self-experimentation. All species welcome Science Friction. Listen via the ABC Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.